The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
What was your role in creating this book?
As lead author, I provided guidance for working with the two tribal groups to tell their own stories of their seasonal rounds, and I provided background information, historical information, and context for the future.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, and I'm talking this time with Sally Thompson, archaeologist, ethnographer, ethnohistorian, and lead author of a book titled People Before the Park, The Kootenai and Blackfeet Before Glacier National Park. Tell us about the Kootenai people who have not, until recently, wanted to share their stories with outsiders. What was their life like before Glacier National Park was created?
They had a beautiful, rhythmic way of knowing the land, moving through the land, honoring its flow, and being one with that. They have stories among the Kootenai people that take them back probably 8,000 years and longer, but one story actually documents a connection with this region going back that far. And so I would say it's hard for any of us today to actually fathom what it's like to have a relationship to a landscape like that.
And the story that goes back 8,000 years, what is it?
A story about a time that ash fell from the sky and gathered so deep that it choked the life out of the plants. And then the animals died and most of the people died. And remnants gathered and began again. And the only ashfall in our region that would be deep enough to choke out plant life was when Mount Mazama exploded and created Crater Lake. And it was about 7,700 years ago.
The stories that you found and the stories that you heard tell the life of people as they're traveling seasonally through the area that's now the park?
Yes, and they're in and out of the park much more frequently than I imagined when we started the project. And we decided to use their moon cycles as the way to tell the story because, unlike our Roman calendrical system, theirs tells about this land, and it's so rich in telling just to know the name of one moon. And often you can see why you'd be moving because the name of the moon would reflect some changing resource, a food source often, or just a sign that it was time to be on the move to go to the next place where something would be ripening or animals would be gathering.
So in that landscape, it's pretty rugged. Anybody who hasn't been to Glacier National Park has probably seen photographs of it. Really high mountains. This isn't a place you would just stroll around. So how did they travel back and forth?
Well, for the Kootenai on the west side, the North Fork, for people who've been up to Pole Bridge or to the Canadian border, the North Fork itself is pretty accessible. It's a wide valley and easily traveled, although I guess people today don't think so with a bumpy gravel road. So that was a major area for encampments, and when the camas would come ready, people would be in there, and the men would be going up farther up into the mountains, and the camp may stay down in the valley. But a number of times a year, people crossed over those mountains, and the stories are fairly unbelievable. They would make for a good movie. They crossed the mountains in the winter on snowshoes for buffalo and managed to get up over Logan Pass, and we know how hard it is for the Park Service to keep that road open with machinery. And obviously they weren't on the road, but just to be able to travel over those mountains, quite amazing. There's a story that was told to an anthropologist in the 30s about one man's recollection of being on a trek up over those mountains. And we're not sure exactly when this was, but probably the 1860s or 70s. And they experienced two avalanches during this journey and survived. In the first case, these young men got up high enough that they watched the avalanche. They watched an old man just hold on to a big ponderosa, get on the backside away from the snow, and it just went by him, and he held on, and then they all walked out. The second one, everybody was washed off the trail with the snowfall, and nobody died. They knew how to work together to rescue as they could. But the one who was telling the story said he recovered his rifle, which then helped him dig out his wife, and that the snow had already set up around her and that it was really hard to get her out. But everybody got out unscathed. And then they went up over the cliffs, the series of cliffs that make up Logan Pass, using braided rawhide ropes to pull everything up. Men, women, children, supplies up one ledge after another until they were all on top. And then it sounded like fun on the far side. They would put their packs and just let them slide, you know, down after that hard work of getting to the top. Then they would camp over on the lake on the other side, and there'd be small groups of buffalo wintering in protected valleys there, and they would hunt.
But they knew where those animals were.
They knew the patterns, yeah, and a lot of predictability, but not always. Right. So sometimes they would have to go much farther than expected, or sometimes you'd hear stories where people, you know, came back empty-handed and barely survived, or they always had a backup plan. So unless things were extreme, there would be some other source of food. In that same story, some of the men stayed out for months. So this happened right after the New Year's. They were in January when they went up over the pass, and they split, and some of the people went up into Waterton Lakes area and then some out into the Two Medicine area. And I guess most people went back home at some point with some buffalo meat, but some stayed longer. And it was April, I think, that they found themselves on the South Fork, which is now in the Bob Marshall. And they met a band of lower Kootenays who had a canoe or canoes. And they thought, boy, this would be a great way to get all of this dry meat back and hides back instead of packing it. So they traded. They traded meat for elk hide, and they made another canoe and maybe more than one canoe. Sorry, I don't know the detail. But the men and the goods went down the wild South Fork in their canoe, and then the women and children walked alongside, and they returned home that way.
As you said, the Kootenai lived mostly on the west side of what is now the park. And then on the other side were various bands of Blackfeet. And they had more access to the plains where the buffalo lived, more of the buffalo lived. So what was the protocol if the Kootenai wanted to go over into a place that was Blackfeet territory? How did they handle that?
The relationships varied depending on abundance, is what I can tease out of the record. That when life was good, there was a kind of appropriate protocol one would follow to ask permission to hunt or to travel across the other's territory. And as long as there was plenty, then people were open and receptive, and they often would even camp together and gamble and horse race. Horse racing was huge. And a lot of gambling with people would risk a lot for a good horse. So there are a lot of stories about that. And stick game has been going on forever. But it seems that in times of scarcity, and then more and more through time after there was so much competition, once the fur traders were putting that pressure on people and more people coming in, that there was less opportunity for that kind of reciprocity, and there was more fighting and exclusivity of territory.
The Blackfeet culture includes something called bundles. What does that mean?
The people through time have been given teachings to instruct them in how to live in that world, that particular world, that homeland. And the teachings have come from the spiritual world. Some of the bundles have come from Chief Mountain. Some have come from animals. So there's a beaver bundle. There are actually several beaver bundles, and they're enormous bundles with over 100 objects and songs to go with each object. The object might be, say, the skin of a fawn or the head of a kind of bird. And then there would be a song that would teach them all about that animal, its relationship to other things, how it likes to live, and how all can be in balance is the whole, if you take it as a whole, it's their world, their living world, and how to care for it. That there are also a lot of thunder pipe bundles. And then there's a sequence of when those bundles get opened and they have the ceremony and do the dances and sing the songs and then follow those protocols as their spiritual guidance for their seasonal round. And then when they close up the bundle after that opening, people will put like tobacco or something to carry their prayer. And then in the fall, those bundles will be reopened and the people's offerings will be returned to them with it that they've been blessed by being in the bundle, being cared for. And a couple will take care of the bundle. They're like the parents or the keepers, the caretakers. And so it's a balanced, a man and a woman need to do it. They're usually a couple, a married couple, but not always. And sometimes they'll take that responsibility for many, many years if there's not somebody ready and stepping forward to take on that job. It's a huge responsibility to the community to be a bundle keeper. And there's been a lot of revival. It seems like in the early part of the 20th century, times were very tough on both sides of the divide, for all the Indian people in this region, probably everywhere. And so with poverty and pressure on people's lives, they had a hard time with keeping up. And so some people would end up carrying the bundles for a long time, for decades. And then more recently, the last 50 years, there's been a resurgence of interest and people stepping forward and more bundles, reclaiming bundles, getting them repatriated from museums and being brought back to life in the community.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Sally Thompson, lead author of People Before the Park. If you just joined us, you can hear what you missed online. The audio is posted on our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook and Twitter pages. When we come back, Sally Thompson will read a short passage from the book, and we'll find out why adapting to reservation life was particularly difficult for the Blackfeet people. I would say most, if not all, Native American tribes have long-standing grievances with the federal government because treaties weren't honored. And there's a short passage about how the Blackfeet were forced to give up land that had been legally designated as theirs. And that's according to the treaty in 1855. So I'd like you to read those paragraphs.
In 1882, south of the Sweetgrass Hills, the last Blackfeet buffalo hunt took place. After that hunt, the Blackfeet became completely dependent on government annuities for their survival. Thousands of hungry people moved to the agency on Badger Creek, yet because of unscrupulous agents and an unreliable system, rations were rarely, if ever, available. The winter that followed is still known among the people as Starvation Winter, when hundreds of Pikuni died. Today, the ridge behind Old Agency is called Ghost Ridge because so many people were buried there that year. 3 decades after the Lame Bull Treaty, only a fifth of the original numbers of the Piikani people remained, and the buffalo were gone. In 1891, just when it seemed things could not get much worse, the Great Northern Railway cut through the heart of the Blackfeet Reservation, setting the stage for land cessions and the creation of Flathead Forest Reserve, and later Glacier National Park. In 1895, under significant pressure from U.S. government negotiators, including naturalist George Bird Grinnell, the Blackfeet ceded 800,000 acres of mountain lands along the western edge of the Blackfeet Reservation. For the Blackfeet, this ceded land along the backbone of the world was akin to their church. The mountains held gifts from the Creator, providing for their long-term health and well-being. The high peaks allowed seekers to reach toward Creator Sun while staying connected to Mother Earth. White Calf, the Piikani chief, complained to the treaty commissioners about the loss of these mountain lands, to no avail. In the spring of 1898, soon after the ceded strip agreement took effect, 300 miners flooded into Blackfeet country, creating the boom towns of Alton and St. Mary in the heart of fall hunting territory. Although the Blackfeet had retained rights to hunt and gather in the area, with all these new settlements emerging, along with the general hostility felt toward the tribe, their ability to access the mountains became increasingly more difficult. Then, with the establishment of Glacier National Park in 1910, the courts ruled that the rights of access to gather and hunt were now extinct. The Blackfeet have never accepted this decision, one that abrogated their 1855 treaty rights in the area, as well as the 1895 agreement.
How was reservation life different for the Kootenai and the Blackfeet?
The Blackfeet suffered a lot more. The expectations of the U.S. government for people to become farmers was a little bit more likely to happen in the rich lands of the Mission and Flathead Valleys, and not on the lands that the Blackfeet occupied on the east side of the divide. And, you know, for men especially who had been hunters and that's how they took care of their families, the new lifeway was devastating and continues to be. I think it's harder on men than women. Women have been able to kind of adapt their ways of serving the family and the community much more easily. And then the agencies moved with each change of the reservation boundary. So beginning at Fort Benton and then Shoto and then Badger Creek. And then the agent's wife didn't like living there with Ghost Ridge behind her. And so she liked the flowers she had seen in the area that is now Browning. But it was never a settlement. It was a boggy area. But she convinced her husband to move the agency there. And a lot of people died from that move because it was not a healthy place to live. The wet ground was terrible, and people got TB and various diseases, and it was not good. So that and being so confined and having no buffalo. And the word for buffalo in Blackfeet actually means real food. And the word for cattle, I've been told, meant not real food. And so when the government came and said, we're going to, you know, bring you cattle, that the buffalo won't always last, which is what Governor Stevens told them in 1855. You know, imagine if you translate that into Blackfeet and they're being told, you know, don't worry, you're not going to always have real food, but we'll bring you not real food. I don't mean to make light of what happened on the west side of the divide, because over there, people had a lot of horses, and both sides, horses were really important. But on both sides, other people brought in cattle and horses, and then there was a lot of competition for grazing land. And I know on the west side, they started taxing livestock. And this was a period when the tribal communities were trying to make the shift from their way of living to a cash economy, and they didn't have any cash. And so they couldn't pay the taxes on their livestock. And so, of course, there was a glut on the market and people were picking up good livestock from the tribes. And, you know, all of that was then behind the Allotment Act and making sure that non-Indians were getting the best grazing lands. So it was very difficult on both sides to be confined when you've had this beautiful freedom.
Both the Kootenai and the Blackfeet, and I'm sure all other Native American tribes, have for many decades expressed concern about the environment. That theme came through in the book over and over again. So what does that look like today?
The first tribal community I worked with was Taos Pueblo, and I worked on water rights. And in getting to know elders about water, I came to understand that they have an ongoing covenant with the Creator to protect what's been given. And they remember that at the beginning of time, and this is biblical as well, so I'm assuming all people at the beginning of time had a relationship where Creator provided food, and the agreement was that people would care for the food. And as long as that reciprocal relationship was maintained, then life would be good. And so tribal people who have not had to leave their homelands still practice that covenant to the best of their ability. I remember, you know, just thinking about that a lot when I heard people at Taos talk about their covenant with the Creator. And then when I was working on the last chapter for the book and trying to decide, you know, what we would say, I thought, well, what people probably would most want to know is about cultural resilience and what continues and how do they understand their relationship to the reservation or to the original homeland or both. And I think it was made most clear by one of the Kootenai elders, a granddaughter of the last chief of the Kootenai, who said, if you look at the placement of all the Kootenai bands from up in BC all the way down, they're all at headwaters that lead to the Columbia, and that they were put there by the Nupika, the spirits, to protect those waters. And I think when they say that, again, my own shortcomings from having grown up in the world where everything's separated, I don't fully comprehend this, but what I believe is implied by that is that those headwaters, you know, those springs that feed the rivers and the melting snows, that they hold all of kind of incipient life and they continue to sustain life. And so it's not just the rivers, but all the life that those rivers feed, and that it's their responsibility to keep those, to pray and protect. And it must be such a constant struggle to watch, especially like in the Animas River and that flows through Navajo country, being turned a garish orange from mine wastes. So you imagine, you know, actually the Navajos who relocated to that region in the last millennium, they just moved that responsibility to their new homeland to care for it. And they have four sacred mountains there, just like they did in interior Alaska. And so they are responsible for those rivers, and they realize the absolutely fundamental relationship that they have with it. And so the despair when you see the accumulation of disregard and how it's costing everyone and all the life, you know, all the fish, everything from the microscopic things to the insects to the fish to the birds to the whole cycle of life that is impacted. So it's a hard road to continue to try to protect what you don't really have control over, but they do. And with the Blackfeet, so much of that connection what their leader expressed about this is our church, and it's the understanding again that the headwaters, that if you start polluting, you know, the headwaters, you pollute everything. And then the loss of access, the loss of being able to go up there and seek visions and sweat and cleanse and be in relationship with what you're responsible for is a huge deprivation.
So it's a different cultural outlook. They've been, you know, overpowered by a culture that wants to use all the resources. And the native way before all that happened was to caretake and live in harmony with it.
A couple of years ago, there was a call put out by the 19th pipe carrier for the Lakota people. So this is like the 14th Dalai Lama, the 19th pipe carrier, and it's a similar kind of responsibility. And he said that Mother Earth has a fever, and we all need to start coming together to pray for her well-being. And what really struck me, other than the magnitude of that, he said, we have to stop thinking of her as a resource and understand she is our source. And that, to me, is kind of summed up the difference in the way non-Indians and Indians see the world. Something to exploit or something to revere as the source.
What else do you want to say about the book?
I love that this became a collaboration and transitioned from, you know, me being hired as an anthropologist to write this book, because what's contained in the pages is so much richer once the tribal communities took responsibility for their chapters and knew they weren't just giving me information to have my name on a book. And one of the women that I worked with, she patiently would walk me through certain passages and say, I'd want you to listen again and see if we can't get that worded in a way that more accurately reflects what I'm telling you. And sometimes I just felt like, I can't get it. What are you saying to me? And that's pretty fascinating in itself, you know. It's not like I had just walked in off the street. I've spent a lot of time working with tribal communities, and every now and then I'll realize there's still such a gap. And part of that, I think, is their verb-based world and our noun-based world. And again, the same thing I've been talking about in terms of the interrelationships or the separation of the Cartesian way of seeing the world. They just have a hard time translating from their language to ours because their world is not stagnant. And I think sometimes my language would end up making it too static. And so she would work and work with me to find a way to say it that would somehow convey her world. And she said, it's so important now, meaning since their name was on it, that they wanted their grandchildren to be proud of what they had written. The Kootenai Culture Committee wants to be proud of what is in this book, and the Pikuni Traditional Association wants Blackfeet people to be proud of them, of their life way and the way it was told. So that part was a wonderful transforming journey. It took a long time. It would have been a lot quicker for me to have just written it, but it would have been a pale comparison.
Look for more information about Sally Thompson and People Before the Park at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, book reviews and excerpts and weekly poems, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Michael Marsalek, executive producer, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program. Mm-hmm.